anyway, so my thesis is like a really strikingly simple thesis, that the responsibility to protect doctrine, which was incubated and nurtured right here in dear old Canada before it was unleashed on the world stage, and we have Paul Martin and Michael Ignatieff and other geniuses to thank for that. My theory is that this is not new. This is not a way for the world to now cooperate with each other and get rid of bad things and stop humanitarian disasters. But it is very, very much the same old, same old, same old. And what I mean by that is colonialism. It's not true that the colonialists, when they tried to conquer North America, India, Asia, Africa, the planet, did so by telling their native populations at home, we're doing this because we're greedy, rapacious pirates and we want to plunder and enslave the planet. They always told the people at home, we're doing it for good reasons, for humanitarian reasons, always. The problem right now, and I'm saying right now in the year 2008, is that you have a remarkable confluence, which you haven't had before, between the left, broadly speaking, and the right, who all seem to think that the problem in places like Sudan or Iran or Congo, the problem is that the great American army is not intervening enough. There needs to be more boots on the ground there. And that's where you get a confluence and a convergence of ideas, at least at a very high level, between Mia Farrow, George Clooney, Dick Cheney, and Barack Obama. They all appear to agree about this. And to the extent that the left, so to speak, is critical of the US, its criticism is it's not using its military muscle enough. You should have used your military muscle in Rwanda in 1994. That would have stopped all that horribleness. You should use your military muscle now in Sudan to stop a genocide in Darfur. You should use your military muscle, you name it, round and round the world, right? So the problematic which we now have is that it's not necessarily the Cecil Rhodes of the world. Rhodes was the name of the founder of Rhodesia, and an open theorist of imperialism as being a solution to the world's ills, or for that matter, Ronald Reagan or George Bush, on their own, which is saying that military intervention is a good thing. But it is the left, broadly speaking. When I say the left, broadly speaking, I include in that the NGOs, the humanitarians, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International to some extent, myriads of human rights groups that find themselves trying to give humanitarian assistance in places of obvious disaster, civil war, famine, mass killings, population movements, refugee movements. And they're all there saying, things are really bad here, you've got to come and help. And you can see where that leads recently, when aid workers are kidnapped or killed in Afghanistan, which who could possibly do that? Who could possibly hurt people working for the Red Cross, Médecins Sans Frontières, and so on? And Médecins Sans Frontières and groups like that, Médecins Sans Frontières is probably one of the most famous founders, is Bernard Kouchner, who's now in the Sarkozy government in France, and he is waxing lyrical about the wonders of this new age where we now have, different from the colonialism of the past, foreign boots on soil in Africa and the Middle East, or at least we want to have those, because what they're now doing, different from what the Germans did when they invaded Africa, or from what the British or the Belgians or the French or the Portuguese or the Dutch did in the bad old days, now they're there just for good reasons. They're there to stop humanitarian disasters. In the past, okay, they were bad and they were just there for plunder. Now we have a different kind of empire, the kind the world has never seen before, an empire light, in the beautiful words of Michael Ignatieff. So let me just try and get through. If this technology works for me, it's going to be a miracle. Whoops. So this, what I'm going to call ugliness, starts with a 2001 report of the International Commission on Intervention in State Sovereignty, the responsibility to protect, sponsored by the Canadian government. They had a lot of trouble coming up with that line, the responsibility to protect. I mean, they toyed around with humanitarian intervention and all kinds of other weird and wonderful formulae. But now we have the responsibility to protect. And I just want to pause on that for a second. The responsibility to protect. You have to think about that. It's quite a remarkable slogan. Whose responsibility to protect who from who? I just want to leave that with you for a second, and I'm going to get to it, I think, a little later. So R2P, as they call it, or C3PO, is triggered when a particular state is either unwilling or unable to fulfill its primary responsibility to protect. Okay, so you have a state unwilling or unable to protect its own citizenry. That's what we're talking about, really. Or, I suppose, it's been enlarged to include citizens of neighboring countries. By the way, nobody can quite agree on what R2P is. I mean, there's various iterations of it all over the place. It's just a nice warm blanket we now can throw over these kinds of intervention. So you have to think about that, number one. And by the way, this is very Canadian, I have to say. You know? It's very, very Canadian. I mean, this is a country that has a constitution which promises, as it's, you know, as what we're all yearning for, peace, order, and good government. A little different from the American Constitution, which is, you know, the pursuit of happiness. We actually, I suppose, we're too cold to be happy up here. So, peace, order, and good government, POGG. When I did constitutional law in law school, a wonderful professor, actually, talking constitutional law, Peter Hogg, and was widely known as Hogg on Hogg. POGG, peace, order, good government. Anyway, sorry. So, I guess that wasn't as funny as I thought it might be. But anyway, so, here's number one problem. A particular state might unwilling or unable to fulfill its primary responsibility to protect. Well, there's a lot of stuff hidden within that, skills within there, like the layers of an onion. Firstly, you have to have a conclusion that there is a population which is not being protected. Okay, so how do we know that? That's number one question. How do we know that? Who's telling us that there's a population that's not being protected by its own government? And then, who makes a decision that state is unwilling or unable to fulfill its responsibility to protect its own citizens? And who's making the decision about the extent of the parameters? What is the responsibility to protect your own citizens? If you have, for example, you're living in a state where a province or a city or a group of people is in violent insurrection or wants to escape, wants to create its own state, who decides that in that war situation, the state, which is under attack from insurrectionists, is in breach of its responsibility to protect the insurrectionists or the population supporting the insurrections? Well, who's deciding that? Right? I mean, let's think of a few examples. I'll just give you a couple. The obvious one at the moment, I suppose, is Kosovo. Right? Kosovo. The European community and the United States decided that Kosovo was going to be independent, had a right to its independence from, well, initially the Yugoslav Federation and then Serbia. So they decided that, right, on the basis of the actions of the Kosovo Liberation Army prior to the great American interest in Yugoslavia. The Kosovo Liberation Army was deemed by the U.S. to be the most formidable terrorist force in Europe and the biggest heroin traders on the planet. That changed, and the demands of the Kosovo Liberation Army then became legitimate demands for national self-determination, recognized by much of the world, not recognized by Russia and other places. But somebody made a decision that the Yugoslav government, later Serbia, was not fulfilling its responsibility to protect the insurrectionary part of the population in Kosovo and other populations, Bosnian Muslims and so on. And we decided that was so bad that the international community, read NATO, had to step in and actually remove the government in Belgrade, put its leaders on trial, the trial's still going on, and rejig the territory. So Kosovo now is independent, quote-unquote. I have to say quote-unquote because the leadership of the Kosovo government is chosen by the European Union, which has a final say-so in it. It has probably the largest concentration of US troops in Europe and one of the biggest US military bases in Europe, all in Kosovo. Kosovo doesn't get to decide on things like central banking, foreign policy, etc., etc. That's all controlled by a commissioner from the European Union. But we've accepted various stories given to us by interested parties. Who are the interested parties? The United States, NATO, etc. About the need for humanitarian assistance. Terrible things are happening. Terrible things are going on. We must intervene. If we don't intervene, people are going to die. There's going to be refugees. Because when we did intervene and bombed the crap out of them in the 90s, there were refugees. In fact, the refugee flood grew enormously after the bombing started. And just to remind you about one thing, the charges against Milosevic, 90% of the charges against Milosevic are for things that happened after the NATO bombing started. Okay, so that's number one. Two, when a particular state was itself the perpetrator of the crimes or atrocities. So, you have to have two pieces of proof there, right? One, the crimes or atrocities are being perpetrated. And two, that the state is the perpetrator. Okay? Again, who's going to make the decision? Who's going to tell us that certain actions are crimes or atrocities? And how can we trust them? And how can we trust them not to exaggerate in their own interest? And who's going to tell us, and what kinds of states are going to be liable for this responsibility to protect intervention? Is it, I mean, I just hazard a guess here, I just throw this out, would it be primarily states who are outside the US or European orbit? Would it be states that the US and Europe don't completely control and don't completely like? Could it possibly be states like Zimbabwe, Sudan, Somalia, Iran? Could it possibly be them? Or are we talking about states which commit human rights abuses like the United States of America, Great Britain? Are we talking about those kind of states? And just to pose the question is to give you the answer. It's ludicrous to think that anyone's going to intervene in the United States because of the vast overrepresentation of African-American youth in American jails. That anyone's going to intervene in the United States because it's one of the very few countries on the planet to execute juveniles. That anyone's going to intervene in the United States because of its habit of causing death, destruction, famine in other countries. And let me ask one other thing. What is a crime or atrocity? What are we talking about? I mean, it's very easy to watch images on television about population movements in Darfur and so on. But how about this as a crime, as a crime? I mean, I did a lot of work in Tanzania in the last 10 years. And just as an adjunct to my work, I found out that one in every five Tanzanian children dies before the age of five from measles. This isn't something that happened when Julius Nyerere was in power. But Julius Nyerere's form of African socialism, which included universal health care and free education, was deemed by the International Monetary Fund to be a bad thing. And the free market was deemed to be a good thing. So Julius Nyerere's form of African socialism no longer exists. There is no free education in Tanzania. And there is no universal health care. We have some humanitarians here are very concerned about the rise of AIDS and such in Africa, as they should be. And there are some wonderful doctors and so on who go over there and are worried about measles and so on. But frankly, they can't do anything about it because of the free market ideology that's been imported into Tanzania. How can you stop AIDS when children can't afford to go to school? How do you stop the spread? How do you tell people that they should engage in safe sex, for example? For example. How on earth do you do that? But that's not the kind of disaster that we are for military intervention. In fact, we have intervened in Tanzania. We have intervened to redistribute the wealth from Tanzania to North America. We've intervened there. And we've told them, we'll strangle you as an economy, as a society, if you don't do what the IMF wants you to do. So where does the military intervention go? Do we militarily intervene in Tanzania to enforce healthcare standards? Or did we militarily intervene in the United States to stop them from impoverishing Africa?
Three.
People living outside a particular state are directly threatened by actions taking place there. Obviously some sort of apologia for attacking places like Afghanistan and so on. But let's go back, because if I'm going to plea for anything in this little workshop, it's for international law. And there's a lot of wonderful things in international law, and for very good historical reasons. But it's being ripped apart at the moment. Let me see if I can do this properly. Whoops, I didn't. No. Okay. Nuremberg principles. So after World War II, the Nuremberg Tribunal set out principles which are basic principles in international law. And they describe three types of crimes. Crimes against the peace, which include planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression. I'm sorry, I couldn't get rid of that blue underlining. I cut and pasted it from Wikipedia, actually. Planning, preparation, initiation, or waging of a war of aggression, or a war in violation of international treaties, agreements, or assurances, or participation in a common plan or conspiracy to the accomplishment of any of those acts. Two, war crimes, violations of laws or customs of war, which include murder, ill treatment, deportation, slave labor, etc., etc. And crimes against humanity, murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, other inhumane acts against any civilian population. You can see how these principles, derived from the experience of the civilized world in the face of Hitler's aggression in World War II. I want you just to note something, just think about it for the time being. We now have a plethora of international criminal courts. The International Criminal Court, the Sierra Leone Court, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, for Yugoslavia, one going on in Cambodia and one suggested in terms of the one happening in Lebanon in terms of the assassination of Rafiq Rouri. To my knowledge, none of these international criminal courts has the jurisdiction to deal with crimes against peace. They're strictly limited to war crimes and crimes against humanity. However, the chief American prosecutor, Robert Jackson, at Nuremberg said this: to initiate a war of aggression, therefore, is not only an international crime, it is the supreme international crime, differing only from other war crimes in that it contains within itself the accumulated evil of the whole. So let's take an example, if we can. In 1994, the two black African presidents were assassinated. President Habyarimana of Rwanda and the Hutu president of Burundi. They were assassinated April 6, 1994. Within hours of their assassination, there was already chaos in Rwanda, but the chaos got qualitatively worse, and people started dying. People started hacking up their neighbors and things started happening, right? Now, that happened in 1994. We're now in 2008. Where is the international outrage at the assassination of Habyarimana, which everybody acknowledged triggered the mass killings? Everybody acknowledges that. Where is that? I mean, Olaf Palme in Sweden was assassinated. Everybody got correctly worked up about it and tried to figure out who did it. A right-wing politician in Holland was assassinated about 4 years ago. Everyone's upset about it. Rafiq Hariri is assassinated in Lebanon. We're told Syrians maybe did it. We're all upset about it. Two black African presidents, I'm not talking about vice presidents, but two black African presidents are assassinated in 1994, triggering an unimaginable bloodbath, triggering a regime change, triggering a situation which includes Congo right at the moment and the death of something like 3 to 5 million people in the last 10 years. And where's the international outcry? The International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda says it doesn't, the prosecution said we don't investigate plane crashes. We have no jurisdiction to deal with this. We're just coming to deal with the bloody mess that followed. And somebody pointed out it's rather like, you know, wandering into a room and you see two people beating each other bloody. Well, what do you think of that? Well, that's pretty terrible. You know, there's a crime, call the police. Except you're at the MGM Grand in Vegas, and it's a prize fight. If you don't know it's a prize fight, you don't understand what you're looking at. And if you're looking at, for example, a snapshot of a humanitarian disaster, Rwanda 1994, Darfur 2007, whatever it is, unless you understand what triggers that, well, the root causes and so on, frankly, you're part of the problem. And the International Criminal Court, for example, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, whose prosecutors resolutely refuse to look into who killed Habyarimana and started the bloodshed, and resolutely refuse to prosecute anybody on the current government side, I would suggest is part of the problem, not part of the solution. And particularly since now we have indictments in Europe which say that the responsibility for the death of Habyarimana is laid at the foot of the current government of Rwanda, who presumably knew what would happen once they did that. The problem is then what the new humanitarian intervention teaches us is the opposite of what Robert Jackson, the American prosecutor at Nuremberg, taught us. We're being taught that, don't forget about the crime against the peace, but let's just look at these war crimes and crimes against humanity in isolation and make a decision based on that. And in fact, commit a crime against the peace by intervening militarily in a foreign country. Now, right after World War II, again concurrent with the Nuremberg Tribunal, the United Nations got together, and for one primary reason. The preamble to the UN Charter says the following: we, the peoples of the United Nations, determined to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind. That's the basis of the UN. My suggestion to you is that that's being torn apart at the moment by this responsibility to protect. This is Article 1 of the UN Charter at the top. The purposes of the UN are to maintain international peace and security, and to that end to take effective collective measures of prevention and removal, threats to the peace, and for the suppression of acts of aggression, and so on and so forth. Article 2, at the bottom, the organization of its members, in pursuit of the purposes stated in Article 1, shall act in accordance with the following principles. The organization is based on the principle of sovereign equality of all its members. But we don't believe that anymore, actually. We don't believe in the sovereign equality of nations. What we do believe, I mean Michael Ignatieff and Ed Broadbent and Mia Farrow and Dick Cheney and George Bush and Barack Obama, a whole bunch of very strange bedfellows, is that there are some countries which are sovereign and there are some countries which are less sovereign. Now, there was a whole doctrine of this during the early colonial period about states which were more deserving and states which are less deserving. The genius of the UN, and by the way, this was in accordance with the Treaty of Westphalen going back to the 1600s, was to recognize, as a matter of law, what was already existing in international law, is that all nations are sovereign and equal. All are sovereign and equal in law. Cuba, Zimbabwe, the Netherlands, Ireland, the United States are equal. But now we have this peculiar doctrine. No, some actually aren't. They're failed states. There were states at one point in time, but something happened to make them failures. The criteria are very, very murky, other than they're presumably non-white states, basically, with the exception of Yugoslavia, I suppose. But they're states which came. And once you have failed, you're no longer sovereign, you're no longer entitled to your sovereignty, and you're no longer equal to all other sovereign nations. And it was recognized by the UN and all scholars that the rights of nations to sovereignty were among the most important human rights. Until close to the collapse of the Soviet Union, which is where, by the way, if you want to know what the historical change is, that's the change. That's the change. I mean, the US couldn't consider throwing its weight around the world exactly in the same way, although it did. Well, there was another competing superpower and competing ideology. With that out of the way, we can do away with sovereignty and bank regulation and all of those nasty things that come along with that. But it was believed by virtually all international law scholars that the rights of peoples to self-determination and the rights of nations to sovereignty was a foundation of all other human rights. This is now turned on its head, and we're now told that individual human rights trump the rights of peoples to self-determination, the rights to sovereignty. I think this is profoundly dangerous, but I think in that mix, individual human rights get lost as well as sovereignty. Can I ask you to know a great liberal philosopher? He says the following: nations which are still barbarous have not got beyond the period during which it's likely to be for their benefit that they should be conquered and held in subjugation by foreigners. That's a nice, I mean, I appreciate John Stuart Mill saying that because it's nice and clear. But what difference is that from the rationale of George Bush in going into Iraq? I mean, whatever rationale he had at the moment, okay, forget the weapons of mass destruction, but the final ex post facto rationale which they landed on, which is we got rid of a dictator, we're bringing democracy. And same with Afghanistan. Afghanistan, we're going in there to create security and stability to a very unstable, insecure place, which doesn't accord rights to women, which is an irrational theocracy. Why is that any different from what John Stuart Mill said hundreds of years ago? It's just nations which are still barbarous, and let's fill in the nations which we, who are not barbarous, think are barbarous: Zimbabwe, Iran, Sudan,
Haiti.
They're very good. No, that's a wonderful example. Haiti. What's that?
Somalia.
Iraq, Afghanistan. About Russia. if anyone watched the contretemps over Georgia and North Ossetia, South Ossetia, places which we learn. Okay. This is a quote from a great humanitarian interventionist. I made some cuts so that it's not immediately obvious. It's obvious, not immediately obvious as to who's talking. But I'd like you to figure out who's talking here. Minorities living there have been ill-treated. This was a prelude to a humanitarian intervention. Minorities living there have been ill-treated in the most distressing manner. An attempt was made to try to justify the oppression of the... He names a minority, but I didn't want to say because I'm trying to do something amusing here. Oppression of the whatever minority by claiming that they had committed acts of provocation. I don't know what these provocations on the part of women and children consist. If they themselves are maltreated, in some cases killed, such minorities have been abused, tormented, economically ruined, and above all, prevented from realizing the right of self-determination of nations also for themselves. Who is that? Who made that quote? Any guesses?
Is it Hitler's justification of being born?
Exactly right. That's Adolf Hitler. Adolf Hitler. And Adolf Hitler is telling us that Germans, the minority of Germans, and I think it, by the way, is Germans in the Sudetenland, actually, not Poland, but but he used the same thing. And he's complaining that the women were being raped and killed. Children were being abused. Populations were moving. Refugees were moving. He couldn't sit by. And in fact, if you want the complete quote, he says, you know, I've been trying to do things diplomatically. They won't listen to me. I just got to answer with a sword. I've got to answer with a sword back to them. And let me remind you, if you read your Globe and Mail, that one of our great humanitarians, Stephen Lewis, is telling us all right now that the government in Harare, the Mugabe government, one of its weapons of war is rape. It's raping women. We should get in there and do something. There's a list of places we should get in there and do. And again, my thesis is the list of places includes only places that are on the outs with the U.S., like Zimbabwe for the moment, but you could, I'm not claiming that by any stretch of the imagination Stephen Lewis is a fascist or a Nazi or anything like that, but we have now a spectrum of people supporting imperial military intervention. And we have to say imperial military intervention. When we're talking about military intervention, we're not talking about Iranian troops intervening in Colombia. We're not. We are only talking about NATO troops. This is all we can possibly talk about. I mean, nobody else capable of doing it. And let's not be fool ourselves here. We're talking about the British Army. We're talking about the American Army and Marines and the Canadian Army. These are the people that are going to do it. We're not going to get a coalition of the Stephen Harper. Stefan Dion and Michael Ignatieff, or whoever it is, Bob Ray, rubber stamp a coalition of the willing that is made up of the armies of Libya, Syria, Iran, and China. We're not. And the fact that we're not should give us a lot of pause about what it is we're actually talking about, what we're really talking about when we smooth away these words about, I mean, Hitler hit it all on the head, rights of self-determination. Those poor Germans, their right of self-determination. The Kosovar Albanians, their right of self-determination. The Georgians the Georgians not in Atlanta, Georgia. I mean, Georgia, Tbilisi, Georgia. Their right to self-determination is being screwed up by the Russians. All the humanitarian impulses are right there, protecting women and children. That's what we're doing in Afghanistan. We're protecting women. Their right to go to school. The women who get acid thrown in their faces. And believe me, I'm not saying it's not a horrible crime. Those are horrible crimes. But why are they being committed? I mean, who started the mess in Afghanistan in the first place? I mean, let me just talk about Afghanistan for a second. I can't help it, you know. It's just that I saw this amazing, I think on CBC there, they talked about the poor young girl who had acid splash her face because she wanted to go to school. And that's what we're there for. We're there to let those women go to school. Actually, women were going to school before the Americans intervened to get rid of the Russians. Women were going to school there. There was, in fact, it was a much less theocratic society. And I hope, if those of you with good memories, remember Mike Wallace standing in the mountains near Peshawar with a group of Taliban Mujahideen calling them freedom fighters. We're going to go in and get the Russians out of there, you know? And we did. And we got the Taliban. And now we're saving the world from the Taliban. And then we'll save the world from whoever we put in there next, you know? U.S. interventions, okay. So one of the things that distresses me, and particularly I suppose I speak as a child of the 60s that grew up just always being skeptical about what the US was doing and so on, is a complete lack of skepticism at the moment from people who should know better. And I'm talking about the George Clooney's and the Human Rights Watchers and so on in this world. I was going to put it into this slideshow, a list of US interventions in foreign countries over the last 100 years, but there were 18 pages on the list, and I couldn't squish it onto the slideshow. And it starts in 1890. I'm going to read you some. I mean, just because, you know, even for a skeptical old unreconstructed leftist like myself, I find it kind of breathtaking. So if you start in 1890, the U.S. attacked. And let's take 1890 through 1911, just for a start. The U.S. attacked Argentina, Chile, Haiti, Hawaii, Nicaragua, China, Korea, Panama, Nicaragua, China again, Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, Nicaragua again, Samoa, Nicaragua again, Panama, Honduras, Dominican Republic, Korea, Cuba again, Nicaragua again, Honduras again, Panama again, Nicaragua again, Honduras again, China again, and Cuba again. Now we're talking now, that's 20 years. And if we bring it up a little more recently, up to date, well, let's take the last 30 years just for fun, I suppose. We've got Vietnam, there's Guatemala, by the way, 1966-67, Cambodia, Oman, Laos, Chile, Cambodia again, Angola, the U.S. gave military assistance to South African rebels. Libya, El Salvador. Libya, by the way, you'll remember, shot down naval jets. El Salvador, Nicaragua, we're talking about the Contra operation there. Lebanon, military intervention in Lebanon. Grenada. You remember the Grenada invasion, by the way. That was a humanitarian intervention. And remember, who's telling us this? I mean, when you read the stories of what's going on, the Globe, the Star, this, that, and the other, ask yourself how much skepticism. Remember, they went there to rescue, as I remember, medical students from the US who were being threatened by the Marxist government of Grenada. It was all bullshit. There was a military airstrip being built by the Cubans, by the Cuban army. The Cuban army were there in force. Well, Cuban construction workers were there. There wasn't much evidence of the army being there, but no matter, we've forgotten that. Let's see, what have we got here? Bolivia, Libya again, 1989, Panama. We don't know how many people died in the assault on Panama, where they went to get Noriega and changed changed regime then. And we don't know that, and we all know that now that Noriega's in jail, the drug trade is finished. And also now that we've invaded Afghanistan, the drug trade there is finished. You know the opposite, by the way. There's much more good quality heroin and hashish on the streets of Toronto than there used to be. And we can thank, you know, support our troops, I suppose, is the phrase, if I'm being cynical. Liberia, Iraq, Kuwait, Somalia. Well, Kuwait, let's try that. I mean, and look, this is all an exercise in just memory. We need memory. We really need it really badly. Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait. Nobody had much of an appetite for attacking Iraq until we got this poor woman wearing a chador who came on television and told us that when the Iraqi troops, those brutal bastards, invaded Kuwait City, they took over a hospital and threw premature babies out of incubators. A pretty horrible, and it kind of works you up, right? Except it was a lie. Except the woman was put up there by Hill & Knowlton, an advertising agency, to do all that because the American people needed to be worked up. And look, you know, I'm not disparaging the American people. I mean, I'm glad that they need to be worked up for this. I'm glad people have humanitarian impulses. And it's not simply a question of saying we need to grab the oil in the Middle East, or we need to stop the Chinese from getting the oil in Darfur. Right? Obviously that doesn't wash, and you've got to say to your own population, no, we're going in there for good reasons. We're the good guys. We're the 7th Cavalry. We're the guys in the White House, and we're going to help. Gulf of Tonkin, everyone remembers that the Lyndon Johnson ordered the bombing of North Vietnam because of the attack by North Vietnamese forces on a U.S. Ship in the Gulf of Tonkin. Never happened. Never happened. And the Americans say, remember the Maine. That was the cause of the Spanish-American War, where the battleship Maine was attacked by the Spanish. That didn't happen either, by the way. So we really should remember the Maine, and we really should remember the Gulf of Tonkin and the invasion of Grenada and the invasion of Panama and so on. The difficulty is that as soon as the dust has settled, everyone says, well, we were driven into war in Iraq by a series of lies, weapons of mass destruction and this, that, and the other thing. I mean, I remember the night Colin Powell gave his famous speech to the UN with showing, you know, satellite photographs of trucks and all this kind of crap. I was on a show which is now gone called Counterspin, and I was debating against the head of the Canadian Jewish Congress who has an interest for some obscure reason in attacking Iraq and so on. And I made a bit of a joke. I said, well, you know that there are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq because the proof of that was that the Americans were preparing to attack it. You know? So it's like a joke because they only attack weaker people, that's the... That was the joke of it, you know. So I got attacked in the Canadian Jewish News later that week as being a model-headed leftist. And they gave the joke, but without the punchline. I said, well, there was proof there was no weapons of mass destruction. But then they didn't give the punchline. And the guy who wrote the articles never apologized to me, although I know him. Anyway, so what I'm trying to say is, here we have this massive list of U.S. interventions. I mean, you can't count them almost. And as I say, 18 pages of them that I pulled off the internet. We turn around to them and say, please, Mr. Bush, Mr. Obama, American Marines, you got to help out. We trust you. You're the armed forces there to do the world good, you know. And who's saying this? It's Human Rights Watch saying this. It's Amnesty International saying this. Amnesty, by the way, bought the baby's incubator stories, hook, line, and sinker, and repeated them. I'm not saying Amnesty doesn't do good things, they do. But I read a good book by an Italian anarchist, actually, who says that the NGOs and the humanitarian organizations are the world's new missionaries. The missionaries, as you remember, used to go into Latin America and convert the natives and so on, and then they would come back. When I was a kid, I always remember stories in the British papers about nuns being raped in the Congo. Well, you know, the day after nuns are raped in the Congo, the British Marines are in there, right? Because, you know, we're going to protect the nuns in the Congo. Who may or may not have been raped, I don't know, but there we are. So let me move on. Warren Harding, this is when he was Senator Warren Harding before he came, he said, we unsheathed the sword in the name of humanity, and we gave proof to the world at that time of an unselfish nation. And that's what's critical about all this. Not only do we ask for the Americans to send the troops in, but we say it's a sign of your unselfishness. You're no longer protectionist. You're no longer, I don't know if protectionist is the right word, American exceptionalist. You're not sticking within your own frontiers. It's your duty to the world. So the responsibility to protect is a humanitarian impulse. Just like we're so unselfish to bring democracy to Iraq, to bring stability and peace to Afghanistan. I mean, who could gainsay those motives? They're just superbly wonderful motives. And sorry if we bomb a wedding party full of civilians, they shouldn't have been in Afghanistan at the time. It's their fault, you know? I mean, they should know it's dangerous. And here's our next Prime Minister. The 21st century imperium, because only him, he would use a word like imperium, you know? I mean, anyway, it's a new invention in the annals of political science. Isn't that fabulous? It's just fabulous, you know? An empire like a global hegemony whose grace notes are free markets, human rights and democracy, enforced by the most awesome power the world has ever seen. Guantanamo, Bagram, Iraq, Afghanistan, a new invasion. Does Michael Ignatieff actually think that when the Romans tramped all the way to my native Wales on the one end of the world, they actually went a bit further, and the Middle East on the other, they were saying to everyone, let's do this because we're really nasty bastards, or we're bringing the benefits of Roman civilization with us? I mean, one of the benefits of Roman civilization, by the way, was that anybody could become a Roman. Didn't matter the color of your skin or your religion. You could also become enslaved. You could also become a Roman. I mean, at the time that the Romans were attacking the Jewish uprising in Palestine, one of the generals was Jewish, Josephus. And he was a full Roman citizen. I'm not sure that the 21st century imperium is quite as liberal as the Roman Empire. But anyway, not on that point anyway. And here's a couple of other great humanitarians. National sovereignty is an obligation as well as an entitlement, and government will not perform the role of government forfeits the rights of a government. So here we are, we're back to failed states and deserving and undeserving nations. There used to be deserving poor and undeserving poor in Charles Dickens' times. And so there we go. Let's guess the government David Frum and Richard Pearl think forfeited those rights. Would it be the Americans by breaking international law and attacking Iraq and Yugoslavia and Panama and Grenada and Vietnam and et cetera, et cetera? Why is it attacking Vietnam? The Americans dropped, I mean, you probably know this, I'm boring you with it, but the Americans dropped more bombs on Laos during the Vietnam War than all sides dropped on each other in World War II. And who's been prosecuted for that? I know they're trying to prosecute some aging leaders of the Khmer Rouge. But how did the Khmer Rouge get into power? And by the way, the Khmer Rouge, of course, they have an interesting history. When Vietnam attacked Canada, the Americans protected the Khmer Rouge. But you know, we don't talk about that because our memories are very short, you know. This is the UNESCO Chair of Human Rights, who says the following, which is in line with what I think, I guess. A logical conclusion might be that humanitarian crises are sometimes engineered to bring Africans to their knees, so that from the source of the crises, humanitarians can then intervene to dress up the suffering inflicted. And let me tell you what I think Professor Omara Atunu means. And I get to the most controversial thing, I guess, which is Darfur. So in Darfur, you have a war going on, fighting, and you have rebel groupings, and there are a large number of rebel groupings, and the Sudanese government. And Darfur is part of Sudan, and there are some people who want to break Darfur away from Sudan. So the rebels, by the way, don't exist in a vacuum, actually. Actually don't exist in a vacuum. They're supported by Chad, nearby country, which some of them are supported by Chad, and some of them are supported with arms, money, and advice by the United States and Israel. So, when the crisis happens, and there's this nasty fighting going on there, and the fighting is fueled, in part, by foreign intervention, which is happening, right, which is the foreigners supporting the rebel troops. Human Rights Watch and George Clooney and I'm just disappointed with George Clooney because I enjoy him so much as an actor, you know, but he just stands up and makes a fool of himself over Darfur. But they got to say, well, we've got to intervene to stop the mess. I want to say to Mr. Clooney two things. One thing, we're involved in the mess, actually. Actually, we have been intervening. That's number one. Number two, when the rebel forces understand that their irons are going to be pulled out of the fire by the 6th Cavalry, I said 7th Cavalry, but it's the 6th Cavalry, by the 6th Cavalry, what's their interest in peace at that point in time? And you can tell the proof of the pudding is there. They're not coming to the table. And our great humanitarians, the Human Rights Watch, Stephen Lewis, et cetera, et cetera, who talk about such things. I'm not sure Stephen Lewis said anything about Darfur, but he's talking about Zimbabwe. They don't sit down and talk about international peace conferences, diplomatic pressure. Let's get people together. They talk about sending the goddamn troops. And I tell you something, the JEM movement thinks when they send in the troops, they'll get to power. So what the hell do they need to put their arms down for? No one's telling them to put down their arms, certainly not Human Rights Watch. They're not telling them to put down their arms. So the US then supports a group which is creating chaos there, and I don't know enough about it to see who's worse, the JEM or the Sudanese government, or who's doing which or what. I don't know enough about it, I'm not on the ground. I do know that the Chinese have oil concessions in Darfur. I do know that that's probably upsetting to the United States. But I'm not a conspiracy theorist. But it seems to me obvious that the call for humanitarian intervention, for responsibility to protect, for us to go in there and stop the genocide, by the way, the European Union said it wasn't genocide, the Americans are saying it is genocide going there, but the call to go in there and stop the genocide is creating more suffering. Because the parties are not going to stop warring while the prospect of foreign troops looms on the horizon. And I want to take the other thing, the poster boy for humanitarian intervention, and this is something which I know something about. I've appeared as defense counsel for a long time for the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. The story is about the American government, because of racism, indifference, and exhaustion after Somalia, didn't intervene in Rwanda to stop the killings in 1994. The problem with that is the facts. And the facts are the following. That at a time when the US was twisting arms around the world for intervention and foreign intervention and troops in Yugoslavia and so on, they were similarly twisting arms at the UN Security Council for no intervention in Rwanda. And it wasn't a question at that time about American troops intervening in Rwanda. Madeleine Albright says that she worked tirelessly to prevent any country from intervening in Rwanda. The US didn't have to expend one soldier in 1994. And here's another fact which is stubborn and people don't talk about. The government, which was overthrown in 1994, the Rwandan government, which is now accused of being the architect of the genocide, asked after the presidential plane was shot down, April 6, 1994, went to the UN and said, please send in foreign troops to stop the killings. At the same time, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, now the government of Rwanda, heavily supported by the United States, still heavily supported by the United States, said to foreigners in Rwanda, and this is by about April 10, we will not guarantee your safety. We will shoot on any blue helmets who come in. Now what do we take from all that? Those are facts, they're incontroverted, they're nobody disputes, I think, those are facts. But what do you take from those facts? Was it racism that caused the Americans not to intervene? I'll give you one other fact. The Rwandan Patriotic Front and the Ugandan government invaded Rwanda in 1990. At that time, the Rwandan army, the army which was accused of committing the genocide, was 5,000 strong. Only 5,000 strong. Because the Rwandan government had a treaty with France and a treaty with Belgium. And Belgium and France said, you don't need to have a big army. If you're ever attacked, we'll come and help you. We'll send our soldiers. You don't need a big army. Have a small army. So they had a small army, 5,000 people. And when they were attacked by Uganda and the Rwandan Patriotic Front in 1990, who vastly outnumber the 5,000 people, by the way. France and Belgium sat on their hands. And they sat on their hands all the way through to late in 1994. France sent in something of a force in July of 1994 called Operation Turquoise. It did have some effect in stopping some of the killings that that were going on there. The Rwandan army, by the way, now is 50,000 strong. 50,000, 10 times the size of the army before. And now, that Rwandan army is on... It invaded Congo twice, overthrowing its government once, and is now heavily backing Laurent Nkunda, who is the so-called rebel there, although Laurent Nkunda, to my understanding, was a member of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, now leading his own army. I don't believe that the Rwandan government has ever charged him with desertion or anything like that. So the Rwanda story, I think, at the end of the day, is that the U.S. had a horse in that race. And the horse was the Rwanda Patriotic Front. That horse has come through in spades for the United States since. It's created chaos in the neighborhood and transformed that area of Africa from an area with strong ties to Europe to an area with strong ties to the United States. The U.S. had a horse in that race. It was not going to intervene and didn't want anyone else to intervene militarily because it wanted its horse to win the race. And its horse, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, was really clear that they didn't want any foreign intervention. The hapless party that wanted the foreign intervention, that wanted assistance, was the existing government, which is now overthrown and gone. So you can understand Professor Omara Atunu, who's saying that foreigners have been interfering in our affairs, lighting fires, and then they say, look at that fire. We better come and put it out. The only thing is that when we come and put it out, we change things. We change governments. I mean, does anyone think that, you know, humanitarian intervention, for example, in Zimbabwe is going to leave Mugabe in power? It's ludicrous to think that. That wouldn't be the goal of it. Anyone think that, you know, humanitarian intervention in Afghanistan would do other than put in power a man who used to work for the CIA and Standard Oil, Mr. Karzai, whose government writ, I think, doesn't extend to the suburbs of Kabul. Oops. Hey. So here's someone we should, probably should listen to. That's the Minister of Foreign Affairs of the People's Republic of China, who says we're against any willful intervention on the ground with a rash conclusion that a nation is unable or unwilling to protect its own citizens. That's it. That's good. So that's the problem we have. The problem with the responsibility to protect. Let me just back up a little bit. I was talking about the laws of war. Up until the end of the Cold War, I think all legal scholars understood that there were only two ways that a nation could legitimately use armed force outside its own borders. One was in self-defense. And self-defense is always extraordinarily narrowly construed. You really have to have troops just about to stream over your borders and airplanes in the sky before you can attack back. And the U.S. used the defense of self-defense in the World Court in an action brought by Nicaragua. And Nicaragua is complaining about the Contra War and the mining of its harbors and so on. And the World Court said, well, and the argument of the U.S. is, well, you know, we're going to have creeping communism that's going to come up and kill us all, and also that the Nicaragua is sponsoring terrorism and something like that. The World Court said, that's not self-defense. So, in fact, the World Court at that point in time said, you're talking about humanitarian intervention, because you say you're doing it for humanitarian goals, and that's unacceptable. And they awarded billions of dollars against the United States, which the United States has never paid. The World Court since 1949 said that humanitarian intervention isn't a proper cause of war.